Hey everybody, David McElwain with another episode of Breaker Golden Handcuffs. Today I'm super excited to have with me Chris Lento. Chris has over 20 years of experience in multifamily ownership, management, and investing. He brings a unique perspective to the multifamily real estate investment approach, and he is the founder at EM Capital. Chris, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, David.
Well, thanks for joining us. And, you know, I try to start every program with kind of the same kind of question. And that question is, have you ever had golden handcuffs?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I had a W-2 job right out of college with the same company for 17 years. So, you know, I definitely felt constricted and, you know, didn't know how to get out of that situation.
And okay, 17 years in corporate America doing the grind. So what are the things that you felt like you had handcuffs on when you were in that world?
I think salary or income potential. So, you know, when you're in a W-2 job and it's not, other than sales, I think sales can be a whole different world, but it was not a commission-based position. I was I graduated with a mechanical engineering degree. I was an engineer for, say, 7 years, and then, you know, kind of went up the ladder to program manager or project manager, then program manager. You know, and your compensation is market-based. It's not performance-based as much as people will tell you it's performance-based. It's really, what is the market willing to pay for someone in your position? And then, you know, what you could be replaced at, really. So if you have an amazing year, you're not getting a 50% salary increase. You know, you're getting a market salary increase.
And that market salary increase might be 1%, could be 5%, could be a third of a percent. Yeah. I spent 17 years at one employer and 20 plus years in corporate America until I was shown the door through mergers. Okay. And then I went into the tech startup world and I was shown the door through lack of funding. And so I always talk about if you're a golden handcuff wearer or you're a highly compensated employee, it's not a matter of if you lose your job, it's when and how. I don't know if you had that same kind of experience or not. I was in sales leadership and sales management in the ad business for a long time. So it's a little bit different industry. But did you have some of that as well?
No, it was a little different. So I worked for a research and development company that used to be part of MIT and spun off in the 70s, mainly because we did a lot of defense work. So we had these big 20 to 40 year programs that we were working on with the Navy. So it was almost the opposite. I mean, I was never getting fired, which was part of the golden handcuffs, right?
I mean, right.
It was, you know, you could see this path and it was steady. It was like a treasury, you know, a treasury bill.
Years,
you know,
steady Eddie.
At 3 to 5% a year, hopefully, but probably forever. But it was not exciting. It was, it was hard to impact change, right? So you have, you know, we built guidance systems for nuclear missiles.
Okay.
There was a lot of problems with the procurement cycle and our contracting, but I was not changing anything. I mean, these forces were huge, you know. So having an impact, personal impact, was really not there. But no, I wasn't worried about losing my job. I was more worried that I had no control within kind of my world.
You had no, and I take away from this that the control you're talking about was impacting positive change, making systemic improvements, controlling how your income grew, controlling how your family's net worth grew. So it sounds like your control was,
net worth and just ability to make positive change in that, you know, I could see things that needed to be improved or that, you know, groups that we should no longer partner with. And I just had no influence on that, or very, very minimal. And I could tell that it wasn't going to change. So at one point, I went to Washington, D.C. for 3 years with my company and kind of saw the defense side of it. Like, I worked with the Navy on how they procure. So I got to see kind of the whole
cycle. Belly of the beast of the U.S. Absolutely. Government and its procurement. Yep. And what did we learn?
Oh, well, I would say That whole, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse, the government doesn't know what they're doing thing is definitely overblown. I mean, there was good people in the government that were doing their best and, you know, trying to do the right thing. But the bureaucracy is huge. The problems are difficult. And there's only so many groups out there that do these things. You know, there's like five big defense companies and they're sort of colluding and they sort of have the government stuck in some ways, right? I mean, if you want to pull the contract on a submarine build, well, who's your competitor that's going to come in? There isn't one. There's one company that builds them in the U.S. There's no market demand that you can say, well, this guy's building submarines for Microsoft. We'll check them out. And it's a tough problem.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. So, okay, let's process this. You're in the belly of the beast. You've experienced, I assume decent career growth and all this, and you decide, I finally hit my head against the wall. The cherry blossoms are pretty, but I'm going to do something different, right? Tell me about the journey from where you were to EM Capital.
So right out of college, my first apartment that I moved into in Somerville, Massachusetts, we have a lot of these three-deckers around here. They're like three apartments stacked on top of each other in a single
vertical
building.
Triplex.
Yeah. They're all over the place in the Boston area. So I moved into one with some friends and, you know, we're paying $2,400 a month for our level. And I sort of look around, I'm like, who owns this thing? How does this work? This seems like a great idea. There's three of these. You know, this guy's raking it in. How much do they cost? What's the loan? So I didn't have any real estate background, but I just sort of liked this idea. And did a lot of research, you know, met the owner of my building. He was an electrician who wasn't a real estate guy, sort of like fell into this property. And within 2 years, reading books, talking to people, I had bought a three unit with an illegal basement unit.
We call those non-conforming. Let's call them non-conforming, right. Chris.
In-law apartments.
Yeah. Right.
And, in a less desirable area of the city, but still, you know, a little more affordable. And that's how I started. So from there, for the next 10 years, I was just building this Boston-based portfolio, kind of one property at a time, refinancing, saving up, in parallel with my job. And I always thought of it as like another stream of income. I really didn't pay rent since the time I was 23 to, well, I guess never. I haven't paid rent since I was 23. So that was nice. And maybe retirement bonus was what I was thinking this was. And then as I sort of saw the whole defense industry and, you know, I could see, like you said, I was at the belly of the beast. I saw the other side of it. I came back. I got a big promotion. And I could see all the different jobs, you know, that I could get as I climbed the ladder. And then I think I was in a good position to get. And none of them were interesting. None of them gave me that flexibility I wanted. None of them had gave me control of my salary. A lot of them had me traveling a lot to the West Coast, which I didn't want to do. So at that point, I kind of said, all right, well, I can see the landscape and I don't like what I see. I have this real estate thing on the side, which I do like. And then in parallel, actually, my company started this emotional intelligence leadership training, which was really good. It was great. It's one of the best things.
Did you flunk it the first time or did you pass it the first time?
I don't think it was pass fail. I think it was just, you know, you just went. But I thought
I took an emotional intelligence thing a long time ago. And the first time I took it, I realized I had very poor emotional intelligence. And it took me about 10 years to really change that skill set. Because I was just focused on one thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely learned a lot. And I think I changed a lot as a result of it.
Right.
And I think that those two things, I think the emotional intelligence kind of allowed me to better understand kind of how I was feeling and what I really wanted and what the source of my frustrations. And then that really kind of gave me the insight and the space to think about, okay, what do I like to do? Why is this job really driving me crazy? Why am I so frustrated?
And what did you learn from that? This is fascinating because if you're investing and you're thinking about investing in real estate, there's more to this in the math and the engineering and the mechanicals. There's a whole lot of self-knowledge you have to have to understand the ups and downs of the marketplace. So I'm fascinated, Chris. What did you learn from all of this about what was good and bad in the defense industry for you?
Well, what I learned was that my main struggle was against or a desire for freedom. I wanted more flexibility. I wanted to be able to go in directions that I wanted to go and make decisions that I wanted to make and sort of, you know, be more in charge of my own career destiny. And I just was not seeing a path to that in my company. And then in my industry, like when I looked around, I'm like, oh, I could easily switch over to a Raytheon or a Lockheed. And it's the same thing. You know, there was no change. It would be just a different badge. So that's what I realized, was that what I really want is more career freedom, time, free freedom of time, freedom of money, freedom of opportunity. And I was getting none of that in this job. And that's what I sort of, the revelation came. And then, you know, I had this real estate career on the side, which I really enjoyed. And I started really diving into that and trying to figure out, well, what's the model that gets me to a financial position where I can transition? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you know, in real estate, there's sort of infinite flexibility, right? You can play the game a lot of ways. And it's very self-directed.
Yes. And it is a game in some ways, like every other piece of economic activity. There's risk, there's reward, there's gambling, you know, throwing the dice and not quite knowing what's going to happen. You know, and I think a lot of people hear that, oh, I left my W-2. But what you said is fascinating. You had 17 years in this company, and during that entire set, and it sounds like 15 of those years you spent having two jobs, in essence.
Yep.
And I would say, you didn't wake up one day and say, oh,
done.
It's done.
No. And even, you know, once I kind of was thinking, you know, once I came across the idea that I wanted to syndicate, you know, some aha moments where you can grow this thing a lot faster if you bring in outside capital, you know, if you partner with people, you bring the capital, you bring the expertise. That was a big, you know, moment, getting the confidence to actually imagine doing that. You know, imagine approaching people and offering them investment opportunities.
And holding on that responsibility. For me, what I find is challenging is when I syndicate something is the responsibility I feel toward my investors.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. People think that it's all charlatans and snake oil salesmen, but the reality is that I don't think I've met a single guy or person or woman who doesn't think that the responsibility is immense when you go out and you syndicate. It's huge. Yeah. It keeps us up at night.
I think it helps the underwriting too.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, because I know that I have to, you know, deliver these returns.
And if you don't deliver the returns, you've got to make phone calls to friends and family.
Yep, absolutely.
And then you got to see them over Thanksgiving dinner.
Yep. And have a lot of conversations you don't want to have.
Right. Yeah. I know it impacts my decision making a great, great deal.
Yeah, definitely. And then the other concept that I sort of became aware of was, you know, that you didn't have to necessarily invest in your own backyard. You know, that's sort of a thing you always hear in real estate, you know, invest in your own backyard. And Boston is a really good real estate market. It's, you know, strong appreciation, but it's a low cash flow market. Okay. And it's got a lot of old money and it's got a lot of inside transfers and every building's different. And it's got okay population growth, but nothing like other areas of the country that have basically higher cap rates. So I wanted to test out this idea of going to different emerging markets, which is what EM Capital stands for, emerging markets capital, where, you know, you have that holy grail of higher cap rates and transitioning into a more appreciation-based market. So those were kind of two key insights that I was working to test out while I was still working my job. I transferred some of my assets into some bigger properties out of state and had them professionally managed, you know, with third-party management, and kind of, but this is all my own capital, and sort of tested it out to make sure that I was comfortable bringing investors in on my next go around.
And what was the biggest learning that you got out of all that when you were doing that third-party professional and doing those experiments? Spoken, by the way, like a true engineer.
I would say, one, on the positive side, just the freedom that comes with not doing the day-to-day management, and really what goes into all that day-to-day management when you're doing it right. So I was managing my 12-unit portfolio here in Boston, and I was, in retrospect, sort of doing the bare minimum. I mean, I wasn't doing market evaluations on a quarterly basis and raising my rents accordingly. I didn't have a routine maintenance schedule. I wasn't doing anything to kind of improve the residents' opinion of the building, like resident events or any sort of things to make it sticky so they would like to stay there beyond just the building. And so it was kind of on a positive way, a double-edged sword, right? So I moved to third-party management where I learned a lot about what you should be doing, and it freed me up from doing a lot of the things I didn't want to be doing, like fixing things on, you know, a Sunday, or just having, you know, the idea that someone might call me with a problem kind of hanging over my head.
The tenant's toilets, so I guess, the tenant's toilets and termites freedom.
Right, right. And there weren't many of those, to be honest, but even one every 2 months is enough that when the phone rings, you're kind of like, oh, is that a problem that I have to deal with now? And then it's not, but it was because you had that feeling for you know, a minute.
So it sounds like you actually played really solid baseball, to use an analogy here, where you did a single and then you did a double and then you advanced the runner and you did a triple. And you went through every base to learn every part of the process. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And, you know, I think I'm relatively conservative engineering background. You know, things need to work. I'm not a very let's bet it on hope kind of person.
Right.
So yes,
I used to say when I was in the sales business, I had a manager who worked for me who said, "Oh, I hope this happens. I hope this person calls me back." And I used to pound a phrase, "Hope is not a strategy."
Right.
Right. Boy, she hated that. I can see the conversation now. You're right. You can't bet it on hope.
Right. Yeah.
So tell me, you talked about being a conservative underwriter and about all the experience you've had. What are some of the pros and cons in your mind of buying apartment buildings?
Well, there's a lot of competition. You know, it's a competitive market. So I think it's not as easy as, you know, maybe a lot of the educational material out there will have you believe. I mean, you know, it does take a lot of relationship development. It takes a lot of hard work to find these deals, to, you know, in the beginning have lenders be willing to lend on these deals. So it takes a long time to get the knowledge and the track record and the relationships to make it a lucrative business. It's not an overnight thing. The pros and cons. I mean, I think the pros are that it's a very stable asset class. You know, the U.S. does have a relatively large housing shortage that is actually closing, but not closing fast. And not getting any better, at least in the next, you know, in the near term. So your demand is outstripping your supply, which is a great kind of macro indicator that it's a good area to invest. And it's very understandable too. I find when I'm talking to investors, it's a very tangible asset to invest in. Like almost everyone's rented something at one point. They've been in an apartment building. They're like, I get it. Someone owns it. I paid rent. I mean, it's not that complicated.
It's literally not rocket science.
It's not rocket science, right?
And what do you think
that works with investors though, because they can relate to it. They can understand it.
Yeah. And if you are an investor thinking about this, that makes sense to you too, I imagine. And so some of the pros are stability, understanding, demand, supply constraint. What are some of the cons in your mind?
Like I said, the competition, there's a lot of people chasing deals out there. So, you know, that can drive prices up, or make things, make the numbers not work on a lot of deals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, relative to other real estate asset classes, at least, there's typically not huge upsides, meaning, you know, you can do a value add in what I do, which is existing apartment buildings.
Okay.
You can do a value add and add market, you know, increase the market rents, but you're not going to do some value adds like you might do on an industrial property or a office space where you can double the rents.
So you're talking about, you know, over the course of time, you get a 2x return. And then in some of those other asset classes, you might get a 3x return, but you've got a greater risk portfolio. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. So I guess relative to other asset classes. I mean, and then the other con is it's not a liquid investment.
Right. It's definitely illiquid.
It's illiquid. Very illiquid.
If you don't understand that, pay attention to it. When someone calls as an investor and they say, oh, I want my capital out because Sally's going to get married and I got to pay for a wedding. The answer is, oh, you can't have your capital back.
Right. Right. That means you didn't set expectations up front, right?
Correct. As an operator, that means that the operator made a mistake. But, you know, I've heard these stories many, many times over, right? Oh, I need the cash out for X, Y, or Z. Well, okay. There's only one way to get the cash out. That's to sell your shares at a discount.
Right. That, somebody, right?
Right. And you got to find the buyer, and then it's an ugly process.
Yeah.
So
agreed. So it is not liquid.
Yeah. So over this 20-year journey, when you look back a little bit, what kind of advice, what's the best thing that you know today that you wish you had known 10 years ago?
So this concept of who, not how.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have a problem or you need to do something, you have the book too. I have the book yet. It's a good book.
Yeah.
You know, rather than banging your head against the wall and trying to figure it out, and, you know, coming from an engineering background, I'm pretty confident I can figure most things out. But it's not whether I can figure it out. It's whether I should be figuring it out. And I had this before I read the book. You know, this was told to me at certain points. You know, find the person who already knows the thing that you're trying to do and likes to do that thing. And then work with them, hire them, partner with them, you know, leverage their experience, because people like to do different things.
Very much so.
You know, just because you don't like it doesn't mean you're dumping it on someone. You got to find someone that's their thing. They're excited about that. And on one of my properties, we had a third-party manager that we fired, and we had to hire our own W-2 kind of leasing agent and maintenance man to run the property. We just could not find a professional company to do it.
Was it two people you were hiring, or two one?
People.
Two people. Okay.
Two people.
One in, one out.
No, it was we fired the PM company.
Well, one inside employee, one outside employee.
Yes, correct.
Yes. Yep. Yes.
Exactly. So all of a sudden, I became like a mini property manager of the company. I had to, you know, buy AppFolio. I had to do all the stuff that the leasing agent didn't know how to do. And this was not what I wanted to do. And I was, you know, I know how to read AppFolio. I don't want to be doing it. Like,
right.
And I ended up going to one of my other third party property managers from a different property. And there was a woman there that I had a good relationship with. And I said, hey, would you work, you know, 4 hours a week for me in the evenings, just reconciling accounts, making sure that this back end stuff that I don't understand is working correctly. Then yeah, that she knocked out of the park. So like that idea that, you know, you don't have to do everything. I wish I had known that earlier.
I think that's a great skill and lesson to share. I know when I was younger in my life, I believe that the solution, if you want it done, you have to do it yourself.
Right.
And that's an absolute fallacy. The most powerful leaders, the most powerful organizations believe in tremendous delegation and tremendous sharing and teamwork. And I think, you know, what you're talking about is the idea that who, not how, makes perfect sense. And I do some executive coaching as well. And I had a client that I had read the book, and they came in 3 days later and they ran a business where they were the number one salesperson and the business owner. They gave all of their active accounts to their team because he realized he was keeping the company from growing. I mean, and it's powerful, and his world's changing exponentially every day because of it, to the good.
Yeah. I believe it. I mean, it's a pretty powerful concept.
Yes. So if you, who, not how, is a great piece of advice. What's a piece of advice you followed that you wish you had ignored?
I think the idea that I mentioned earlier of that, you know, you always want to invest in your own backyard for real estate specifically. You know, there's advantages, but there's a lot of disadvantages.
So especially depending on where you live, right?
Right, right. You know, there's some areas that are great to invest, and there's some areas that aren't as good to invest. And you can usually find a deal in any market, but you'd rather be kind of with the tide than swimming against the tide. And then another thing, you know, how those two sort of best and worst come together is before I bought a apartment complex in Florida, I bought one about an hour outside of Boston with the idea that I'm going to treat this like it's in Florida. I'm going to visit it once a quarter. I'm going to have my property manager do weekly calls with me. And I couldn't believe how freeing that was, because even though I had property management on my Boston properties, if there was a little problem, I just felt so compelled to go fix it or go look at it, where being an hour away, I had to rely on the property manager, which freed a ton of time up for me to do higher value activities.
What a great lesson for emerging ACT operators, because you can test your experience from right. an hour away, because you can get there in an hour, but it's not convenient.
Right. So any problem was a minimum 2 hours or two right. hours and 20 minutes, right?
At minimum, right.
Right.
Yeah. I love that. That's cool. Thanks for sharing that with us. So, you know, we're coming down to the end here. Is there a thought or a quote that drives you that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, there's this concept called praxis, or this gym I used to go to was called Praxis. And the way that they described the name was that you are what you repeatedly do. So, you know, a lot of times people say, like, I want to be something, or I want to be good at this. So you tend to, or I want to, you know, I want to fly fish in my retirement, but now I'm going to work 80 hours a week. Well, you know, if you work 80 hours a week for long enough, who you are is someone who works 80 hours a week. So the idea that, you know, do the thing that you want to be. You know, if you want to be a real estate investor, start investing in real estate, and you'll eventually be that. So I like that idea.
Praxis is a great concept. Yeah. You're an attorney, you practice every day. You're an exercising guy, you exercise every day. Yeah. Makes perfect sense.
Right. Very simple. Sometimes praxis.
Praxis, right?
Praxis, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There.
But you are practicing. And then Correct. You become it through, and you right. become, and it's a present tense is, as opposed to a right. past tense. Right. Yep. Yeah, I love it. So tell us, what is the best way to get a hold of you, Chris, if we want to learn more about EM Capital and about you?
Well, you can find me at emcapitalgroup.com, which is my website. It has links to okay. all my contacts. And I can be reached at Chris Lento, L-E-N-T-O, at emcapitalgroup.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And you've been listening to another episode of Brick of Golden Handcuffs. If you enjoyed this show, hit the subscribe button down below and follow us on YouTube. Thanks for listening and have a great day.